Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. We hear a lot about America's failure to educate students in math and science, a problem that many people believe is stifling innovation and the economy. Here's President Obama at an Intel plant in Portland, Oregon last year.
Over the next 10 years, nearly half of all new jobs will require education beyond high school, many requiring proficiency in math and science. And yet today, we've fallen behind in math and in science and in graduation rates. As a result, companies like Intel struggle to hire American workers with the skills that fit their needs.
But not so fast, argues one of my guests. He says that the hand-wringing over math and science education is really all wrong, and the notion that American education is not producing enough workers in these fields is a myth. We will get to that part of the story in just a few minutes. But first, for a sense of the most recent polling data and whether the American public has actually joined in on that hand-wringing, I'm joined by Shane Lopez, senior scientist in residence at Gallup. Shane Lopez, thanks for being here.
You bet, Kara.
So, yeah, first I want to ask you about this seminal question, which is how concerned are Americans that students coming out of high school and college are just not ready for the job market?
Well, there's a bigger issue. The confidence in the public schools today is the lowest it's been in history, based on our polling. And also, the Americans' view of the students' readiness for work is quite low. So, whether you're coming out of high school or college, the typical American believes that the typical student is not ready for the workforce.
Now, you know, I know there's a difference in how people view the schools around them. When you ask, you know, how's your local school versus the national
right.
picture, give me a sense of how people feel about the schools that are close to home and how people feel about schools across the board.
It's very interesting. Americans have a love affair with their local schools. They think their local schools are quite good and their students are getting a good education. If we ask them about schools in the nation, and the public school system at large, they believe it's quite bad or average or bad. So they view their public schools as being kind of the exception to the rule, but the problem is every person views their public school as being the exception to the rule.
How do you explain that? Do you have a sense of why people like their own schools so much, but they have such a problem with the schools out there that aren't near them?
Well, we have a, you know, more of a relationship with the schools that are nearer to us, so we may feel as though we know them better and we see the strengths and the weaknesses and appreciate the good in our schools. But I believe it's attributable to this endowment effect where, you know, we've committed to sending our kids to these schools and gosh, it would be hard to sleep at night if we really believe they were bad schools.
And it's a little bit like the polling for congressmen. People really like their own congressmen, but Congress
right.
in general, a disaster.
Exactly.
Right?
It's a parallel phenomenon, and we see that across the country when we are talking about congresspeople or schools.
So let's talk a little bit about test results and your sense of how people feel about results. You know, last year we saw the PISA results come
mm-hmm.
out, which is this international test, and it showed that America was 17th in reading in the world, 23rd
right.
in science, and 31st in math. So that puts us behind all sorts of countries, South Korea, Canada, Slovakia. What's your sense of how people think of us in relation to the world?
Yeah, I don't think Americans have gotten that news that we're way behind in math and science based on the PISA results. In fact, we struggle to ask good questions about the PISA results because many Americans don't know about the PISA test and how it ranks folks by country. But what we do try to do is we tap into what these other countries, let's say Finland, their approach is to train the best of the best students to become teachers and the best of the best folks in math and science to become their scientists of the future. So we asked Americans, suppose the brightest person you know said she wanted to become a teacher, what are you most likely to do, encourage them or discourage them to from doing so? And most Americans would encourage them. So taking this discussion kind of down the pipeline a little bit, Americans do see the best of the best becoming teachers and trying to teach the math and science to the future students, but they don't have a great grasp of how supposedly we're struggling in the area of math and science.
I wonder how much do Americans actually connect the education system to the economy itself? Do they see a sort of crucial linkage there? What do you
yeah.
hear?
Yeah, right now during this political season, we're keeping a close eye on what Americans care about most, and the number one issue, of course, is the economy, and number three or four is education, and it probably education will not rise to the importance of the economy during this election cycle, but what we don't see is that connecting of the two, that a great educational system will lead to a better economy. It may be in part attributable to how we ask the questions, but as I read through our polling results across the board over the past few years as related to education and the economy, the typical American is not thinking along the lines that you just suggested. If we had a great educational system, our economy might improve.
And beyond education, do you see Americans really worrying about competition from other places, just in the job market? I mean, you hear President Obama standing at the Intel plant and saying, this is a problem for Intel. They cannot get the skilled workers that they need. Do you think Americans are also worried that other people from other countries may take the kind of industries and jobs that we want here?
Yeah, I think that worry is there, but just like with the congresspeople in the schools, the problem is more local for the typical American. Are there jobs in my community? Are there jobs in my small town? Are there jobs in my neighborhood? So most folks are worried about their own job and how it relates to their income and welfare rather than these broader national and international pictures.
Shane Lopez, Senior Scientist in Residence at Gallup, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Kara. Thank you.
So I'm going to go right now to Hal Saltzman, a professor at Rutgers University who really studies math and science jobs. And Hal, I'm going to you have a piece in the journal Nature that you wrote, and it starts with a sort of really provocative opening. And here it is. It's a familiar story. Children around the world have been tested, and the U.S. is in trouble. But you argue in this piece, it may be a familiar story, but it doesn't mean it's the right story. Talk a little bit about that.
That's right, Kara, that it's the storyline, I think, as our last guest talked about. It's what we've been led to believe. But when you actually look at the evidence, we just don't find it. It just doesn't bear out. And part of the reason is these tests talk about the average. So unfortunately, we have a problem at the bottom. We have a very large, poorly performing population. But that's very different from the problem of having enough scientists and engineers and high-performing students. I don't meet many employers that are looking to hire from the bottom. For those jobs, they usually want to hire at the top. And when we focus on the top, we find out we have the best educated, highest performing students, and about the largest share of the world's population of high performing students. So
it's interesting because we hear from industry leaders that there's a serious problem. In fact, let me play a clip for you of Ursula Burns, who's the CEO of Xerox. She's talking here to Soledad O'Brien from CNN, and she talks about that the idea that she cannot fill the math and science jobs that she has at Xerox is a serious problem for her. Let's listen to it.
The work has to be done, so we send the work to people in other places that can get it done. This is absolutely backwards.
You run a Fortune 500 company. Are you worried about finding employees for your company who can do the job?
The answer is more than worried. I'm living with the problem. I'm panic-stricken about it.
Hal Saltzman from Rutgers, what do you say when somebody says, look, this is keeping me up at night. I can't staff my company.
Well, you know, from an employer's perspective, I sympathize with them. I hire graduate students, and I have exactly the same problem, which is I'm looking for absolutely brilliant graduate students who want to work for minimum wage, and I just can't find them. Now, I do have some very good, brilliant graduate students, but I have to pay them a lot more. And the problem really is one of price versus supply. That the supply is here, you have to pay for it. And we, in fact, have, you know, we've looked at this in great detail. We talked to employers, and every time we push through it, we find out the story is a little bit different about what you're competing with. So yes, it's difficult to find great, you know, engineers, for example, who want to work at the China wage or the India wage. That is a real problem, but I'm not sure that's a shortage.
I'm Kara Miller. We're talking today about math and science education and whether we have a real deficit of jobs in this area or whether we have a real deficit of people. And I'm joined by Hal Saltzman from Rutgers University. And Hal, I have to say, the reason that you're on today is because we did a segment on this a couple months ago, and we had people who are leaders in industry, and they said, we're having serious problems. And you wrote me and said, You know, I research this all the time, and I just don't see it. And I'm going to play a clip from a vice president of Raytheon, Paul Clegg, and he is talking here about whether he sees students with inadequate skills in math and science or whether he's really just facing a lack of bodies. Let's listen.
In our view, it is a supply issue completely. It is not a quality issue. We recruit from more than 100 engineering schools, and we have strategic relationships with 25. And there's a terrific synergy between the needs that we have as an employer and what those schools are able to produce in the way of students. The issue is there are just simply not enough students who are interested. I mean, what it comes down to for me is if we could get young people, and we are, we're dedicating ourselves as a company, and many of our competitors are doing the same. The STEM initiatives are getting tremendous visibility and support financially and otherwise. But if we could pique the imaginations of young people in the United States, if they could put as much energy and imagination into the world that creates the instruments and tools that they dearly love, we would have a winning scenario. But at the moment, there's just so much competition for the attention of young people in so many different ways that the engineering and technical path that was once unique doesn't stand out that way anymore.
Hal Saltzman, you hear Paul Clegg, Vice President of Raytheon, say, look, there are simply not enough students who are interested in math and science. What do you say?
I think the problem is a little bit different. You know, we've had these initiatives to increase math, science, education, and interest for quite a while. National Science Foundation has run them, and they've been tremendously successful. We have students taking more math and science than they ever have. They're doing better than they ever have at the top. And we graduate 2 to 3 times as many scientists and engineers every year than are employed. So the problem really is not the overall supply. It's, you know, in his case, probably the ability to get those students to come work for him. They've got more interesting opportunities, better paying opportunities. They don't want to work for him. And you know, I understand he considers that a problem, but it's not a supply issue. It's not that there aren't enough with the talent, the interest, or on the job market.
Yeah, but if they want to go work for somebody else and there's not enough engineers left over for Raytheon, doesn't that come down to a supply issue?
Well, there are not enough that want to work probably at his wage, at what he's willing to pay for who he wants. So we have the big problem comes up. We have this recession. Why aren't there more people out there? And you hear kind of this odd complaint in the midst of high unemployment. And those who've studied it, there's a certain a recession reversal, which is when job markets are tight, you're willing to take somebody who's good and train them to know that you have them. In a recession, you think the perfect candidate must be out there, and they're not going anywhere. So you sit and you wait looking for the perfect candidate, and the person just doesn't exist. That firms are less willing to invest in the training than they once were, and they don't want to bear the cost, understandably, of taking on somebody who may need some training to make that commitment and develop the talent. So it's really a change in expectations, a change in investment, and a change in what employers are willing to do more than it is having the bodies out there who want to work.
And let me just remind people that we are talking about math and science education and whether we're producing enough people in those fields. We're also joined in the studio by Abby Charest. You're at Worcester Polytechnic right now getting a PhD in civil engineering. What do you see when you sit down and talk to your friends about the job market?
I see students having a hard time getting a job. And civil engineering, of course, has been hit a little bit harder by the economy because there's not the same funding for infrastructure. But I do have the chance to talk to computer systems engineers, biomedical engineers, chemical engineers, as the last caller was talking about. And these students are having a tough time finding a job. Some of the top students do get jobs. But when I listen to your show, and here the employer is just desperate for engineers. There isn't this need at job fairs where you feel like the companies are desperate for you. The companies you had on earlier, on the earlier show, said they were going to have to start recruiting in high school.
Yes, exactly. The vice president of Raytheon, who we had heard from earlier, said it's so tight that it's too late to wait till people are seniors in college. We have to lock them down freshman year of college and make sure they're on a track to go to Raytheon because there just aren't enough people.
Yeah, I don't see that. I don't see freshmen or sophomores getting internships. They usually need to wait until they're a junior or a senior, and then it's a struggle to get an internship. And when they do get it, they're lucky if it's paid. They're desperate for unpaid internships.
Now, what do you see in terms of your prospect? Okay, you're getting a PhD in engineering. In some ways, I would think you've got it made. What do you think of your prospects with a PhD in engineering?
There's certainly not a flood of jobs in academia. That's what I'm going for. I am a licensed engineer now and will have my PhD. No one's knocking down my door. In fact, in some ways, I would be expected to try to take a postdoc position or adjunct as a professor for several years. It's certainly, the roads aren't paved with gold.
Mm-hmm. Hal Saltzman, we have a comment on from Bill Hanna on Twitter who asks, what are the prospects for students with only associate's degrees in math and science fields?
For example, in IT, a lot of the IT jobs are don't require a four-year degree. Network administrator, a lot of those support jobs. But it's a tight job market right now, so...
And I wonder, too, we haven't talked much about this, but certainly in Massachusetts, but in other places, too, biotech, pharma is very hot. And yet we see in the last 12 years, U.S. drug companies have cut 300,000 jobs. So talk about people who do research for vaccines, for medicines. What's it looking like there?
It's not looking very bright. In the life sciences, it's one of the most dismal job markets at the PhD level. We've been encouraging people to go into math and science and life sciences, and it's just very, very difficult, particularly at the PhD level. They do one, two postdocs. So you're talking about a bachelor's degree, 4, 5, 6 years of education, another 4, 6 years of postdoc earning $50,000 a year with not very good job prospects in there. And you're right about the layoffs. In the tech field, you might ask Raytheon to look at the 50, 60,000 people that HP has laid off in the last 3 years. Or GE's moved a lot of their engineering operations to China and India. So presumably those engineers are out there. So this is where the message doesn't make a lot of sense. As you see these tremendous layoffs, you see the supply very large. You see more people graduating, they're employed, and yet the employers can't seem to find the people they want.
As we showed with President Obama's clip, we see leaders of the country and leaders of industry saying, we've got to get more people into these math and science fields. We're woefully understaffed. Let's go to Carlos, who is on the road and has a bachelor's degree in engineering. Mm-hmm. Carlos, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So tell us your situation. Have you found it to be easy or hard to get a job in engineering?
I found that my initial idea of just having a degree and finding a nice, 40-hour work week job was completely made up. You're still expected, I believe, and especially now in this economy, to work the extra hours and really put in a lot of hard work, even beyond your knowledge from university, the math and the science plays a role in what you do every day. But it's also your character. It's also how you deal with stress. They want more work out of you for essentially less money.
And are you working in an engineering job right now?
Yes. I work for a shipbuilding company in the engineering department. And I'm a design engineer, a mechanical design engineer. And I started to go into the process aspect of it now. So I've definitely moved up the ladder really quickly, but it's been really hard. And I actually got my foot in the door by offering to work as an unpaid intern. They claimed they weren't hiring at the time, and I said, well, let me just go on as an intern, so when you do start to hire, I have a leg up on the competition.
That's really interesting.
It was that attitude that actually got me in the door, that will not take no, is willing to come in technically as a laborer, and not really come in and go, hey, I have this degree. I want to be at the top level, right from the get-go.
Carlos, thanks so much for that call. That's a great call. Let me take it to Abby Shrest. you know, you see he gets in by saying, oh, I'll work for you for free. And it's also interesting, too, we've heard from a number of callers about this issue of quality of life, that they're looking for a regular job, but they're expected to work incredibly hard. Do you see people making those kinds of compromises, either working long hours or working reduced pay to get jobs in math and science?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I think the expectation when you hear that there's so many jobs in engineering is that you will be able to graduate and get a job. I don't know that anyone's really expecting to work 40 hours, but that you're working a regular work week and you're getting enough money to pay off your student loans. You've just paid a lot of money to get an engineering degree and then, you know, pay for an apartment. But these engineers, again, are getting unpaid internships. They're working for low dollars. They're trying to get government internships when they're available, and those are very low paid. They're willing to do anything to get a job. I don't see them sitting back and complaining just because, you know, they're not making six figures. I see them out there working hard and trying to do the best they can.
Hal Saltzman, one of the things that I thought was most notable when I talked to people about the shortage of people in math and science was that one of the people who came in, Michael Greeley, who is a general partner at Flybridge Capital, a venture capital firm, said, look, the inability of smaller companies to hire is actually holding back the economy in a really serious way. Let's listen to what he said, then I'm interested in what you think.
We're a very active early-stage investor in town. Although we invest nationally, probably half our companies are in Boston. And the common lament across all of our executive teams is their ability to hire people. And then once they've hired them, and a search may take many months, the challenge of retaining, there's such velocity with people who have great technical skills and in such demand. And, you know, as was mentioned, when you have a Google moving into Cambridge or some of these other very large multinational employers who are just absorbing a tremendous amount of talent, it puts a lot of pressure on the smaller, more emerging companies in the market to compete.
Hal Saltzman, how do you sort of reconcile a world which he sees where people are being poached all over the place because there are just not enough people, and then the world we hear from callers, from Abby, the world you've looked at in terms of studying things?
You know, you have to look at there are different segments of the market, and he's sort of in a rarefied environment where he's looking for, you know, these absolute, you know, the brightest, entrepreneurial, top-notch students, your top 1%, 0.5%. I mean, I've talked to some of them, of these small companies, that say, you know, top 1%. We want the 0.1%. That's going to be a tough world, and you're going to compete, but that's the market, and that's the labor market in that they're in. That doesn't talk to the broader picture. But, you know, to that point, we got interested in that, said, well, does this labor market work? Because fundamentally the question is there a problem in the market? You know, is there demand out there that's not being satisfied? So we looked for, we call it a natural experiment. Can we see where there's a real shortage and what happens? And that example is petroleum engineers, where there's a lot of retirements, new exploration, all these things, and companies were hiring like mad. So they did what you do in a market, is they raised wages tremendously. The result was the number of graduates within 2 or 3 years almost tripled. And, you know, students respond. So when we have clear examples of a market example where, you know, employers want somebody, they're willing to pay for it, students respond. And then there are these small niche players of maybe a small company that's looking for the absolute, you know, brilliant person. And that person gets poached by Google. I mean, that top level of talent is always going to be hard. But that's not, you know, the 90% of the job market that they're talking about.
And what have you been seeing with salaries? You said with petroleum engineering, there was a deficit. Mm-hmm. They raised the salaries, and all of a sudden, pretty quickly, people were moving to fill that deficit. People were pretty good at responding to money as an incentive. What's happening with money?
Well, that's the interesting part for all the talk about shortages, is we just don't see wages bumping up like they should if there's a short, with the exception of petroleum engineering and a couple other areas. Otherwise, the wages don't increase a tremendous amount. And if there really is a shortage, if your business is really being hampered, you'd think that you'd want to then pay for it. And what we see in the broad job market, you know, the IT, some of the engineering fields, is it looks to be more an issue of cost. That as long as you have a large supply, for example, with guest worker programs, the pressure tends to be let's bring in more guest workers at a lower cost. And that seems to be the issue there more than not being able to find the talent.
Abby Charest from Woodsner Polytechnic Institute, when your friends sort of sit around, do you think at all about the H-1B visas for talented workers from other countries, which American, you know, American companies really want these visas, right, so they can bring people over? What do you think about the idea of bringing in people from other countries to fill the jobs that Americans maybe are not taking or don't want?
I just haven't really seen that. And more the case is it's very expensive to hire a person that needs a visa. So that since there is a supply, like Kyle's suggesting, that they're not looking at those students as aggressively as they once were. Now they're able to just find a citizen and put them in that job. And that's more what I see. I do think sometimes when they talk about not being able to find somebody, a lot of these places are describing a person that doesn't exist. They want them to have hands-on experience, but they also want them to be able to do computer programming. They want them to have 5 years of experience, and they want to put them in an entry-level position. So it's just this ideal that they want to fill, but there's just not that – there wouldn't be that kind of a person out there.
So why would they ask for somebody who – has an entry-level salary but a bunch of years of experience? Don't they – it seems like companies would know they're setting themselves up for failure.
I think they just think because the job market's that bad and because there is a supply that if they wait, they will find that one person. I was talking to a friend that works for an economics company. They really wanted somebody that was half economics and then could pick up the slack in human resources.
So had multiple degrees they were juggling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me go to Howard in the car, who is a technology recruiter. Howard, what are you seeing?
You know, it's interesting that you put on someone from Raytheon. I mean, Raytheon would be the last place on Earth. I mean, for the most part, it's a semi-government kind of an amazing bureaucracy. Some of the assignments people work on there are ancient history. Some of the things that they do are absolutely dismal. They will never, ever get the top 10%, and they certainly won't get them to stay unless someone's father worked there or something along those lines. These people want to go to the Googles and the other places and work on great things and mobile apps and so on and so forth. And I'll just tell you one other thing. Getting someone hired, you can have a baby sooner than get somebody hired. They change job descriptions. They can't make up their mind. They keep adding things and making the position profile that they're looking for more and more complex. Some of them are really two jobs. I've seen some of them that are three jobs. And I'm just stunned. And another thing, they have to pay more money. They keep walking around saying, man, times are really hard. I can't understand why we can't get anybody. Well, I think Google's probably has a different viewpoint than the guy on Raytheon. So just some thoughts as I'm listening to this. This is fascinating.
Right. So you think that the companies are just setting the bar way, way too high for what they want in a person?
Absolutely. And another thing, if a company wants the top 10%, then you have to be, as a company, you have to be considered the top 10%. And a company like Raytheon or a company like MITRE and a lot of other places, you're not.
Howard, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Hal Saltzman, let me go back to you. I saw you nodding your head while Howard was talking about these demands that companies make.
Right. He hit it right on the head. The expectations are just out of sync for a place like Raytheon. And, you know, from everything from working conditions to pay to what they want to look for. And the desirability of different companies has changed. But the other point that's brought up is training. And that's something else we're seeing, which is, you know, 10, 15 years ago, a company like Raytheon, but most engineering companies would hire a student and expect that they would have 3 to 5 years of learning on the job. That they used to say you wouldn't make back your salary for 3 to 5 years. And today, understandably, they want them to make back their salary on day one, but it's just not realistic. That they're not going to come out of school with that kind of training, productivity, and learning. And so we have this gap about where is the responsibility for that job-ready training? Is it with the company? Or do we change the education system or the stopgap measure to try and put internships? But I think Abby can speak to this a little more. To get a job, you need an internship, but companies don't want to provide the internship because you've got somebody inexperienced, and even if they're free, they cost you money. So we have this mid-transition gap, and to the extent that there's a problem, that's one of them, about who's going to train, who's going to invest, and nobody wants to do that.
A couple of really quick points that you make that I just want to touch on. One is this issue of, for example, China, Shanghai, outpacing us in the PISA tests, and people really worry that we're behind all these companies, these countries, Slovakia and China. Just quickly, what do you make of that?
The tests, it's not clear what the tests mean. That if you look at the companies that do well, the countries, excuse me, that do well on the tests, like Latvia does very well, most of the Eastern Bloc Soviet, former Soviet countries do well, Japan did very well, it doesn't match up with their economies. So it's never clear what you're getting out of the test. Secondly, again, it's the average versus the top. At the top, our students outperform or with the best of the best. You know, here in Massachusetts, when you test just Massachusetts, it's on par with Finland, with South Korea, with Singapore, with all the top performers and, you know, comparable size state versus country. So the tests don't tell you when looking at the average about what really the talent is, how the students perform, or we're really unclear as to what the tests even mean. But we like them because it's a simple number.
And finally, I'm just going to wrap up here with a blast from the past, which you make in your Nature Journal article, right, which is about that sort of Sputnik moment, the space race that so many people, including great thinkers like Tom Friedman of the New York Times, have pointed to and said, hey, you know, the space race was the time when we really got people into science and engineering. And you point out that there was a really interesting side effect after the space race for scientists and engineers. What was it?
That there was a big drop afterwards. Well, there's two interesting points about Sputnik that we forget. First of all, it was demand-driven, which is the government invested, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars and created the demand. It wasn't as though we said, everybody get an education, go become a scientist. They said, we're hiring. So they drew them in. And then it was a big bubble. The same thing we saw after IT, which is it drew these people in, the bottom dropped out, and then we had huge unemployment as a result.
My guests have been Hal Saltzman, a professor at Rutgers, whose journal article in Nature you can link to on our website, and Abby Charest, a PhD candidate at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Great discussion. And when we come back in just a minute, the reality behind internet dating. What does the data show and what works? I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub, online at wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can find our podcasts. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.